Warning, the podcast you're about to listen to may contain graphic descriptions of violent assaults, murder, and adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast, The Murder of Megan Liebengood, Part 3 of 4.
Rob and I watched for a few minutes and decided probably the least culpable of anybody is who we're going to talk to first. And secondly, we didn't know if guy A, not the suspect, was really involved in this. We had a feeling he wasn't, but we didn't know for sure. So we thought by watching his hands rub, couldn't sit down, we're going to talk to him first.
So you go to guy A, who supposedly was a suspect with the postmaster.
Yes.
And you both enter the room, and what happens when you enter?
Well, we ask him, why do you think you're here? That's the best question you can ask, right? And you might think, well, that's a stupid question. No, because if he was involved with the murder or the robbery, he's always going to bring up the robbery first, right? Usually, if they've committed one crime, they go, I don't know. So you got to wait for them to pick and choose.
He's going to pick the less of the two evils, right?
Exactly.
Does he?
Yes, that was about the quickest confession I think we'd ever obtained. We bring up the postman getting robbed, and he immediately, yeah, no, I did that. That was wrong. I shouldn't have. That was something I really, I shouldn't have done it. Admitted to it immediately. And that's because he's relieved that we're not asking about the murder. So as soon as he jumps on that robbery confession, we believe that he's probably directly involved in the murder. He's a juvenile. He knows he's probably not going to get much time for a robbery of a mailman. So he's ready to jump on that grenade real quick and maybe get charged with that robbery and just go on and hopefully that we don't know anything about the murder aspect of it.
So do you lead on with this robbery for a little bit? And then how do you bleed into the murder?
Right. Well, with the suspect that's just for the robbery, he ends up saying that suspect had a gun. He saw that he had a gun earlier that day, and he starts providing all kinds of information about the shooting.
He just tells you that guy B has a gun.
Because once he admits to the robbery, the suspect just for the robbery, he admits to the robbery and the mailman. We kind of play to, all right, you don't seem like the guy that's going to kill somebody. Are you involved in a homicide? And that's when he starts saying, no, what about your buddy over there? Come on. And so he talks about that. Now, during these interviews, they're recorded. So we're recording this interview. And after we get an admission from suspect that's just involved with the robbery, we start to talk to the suspect in the homicide. And like Rob said, that guy gave a confession to the robbery in a heartbeat. I don't think he didn't even want to lie about the robbery, did he?
No, he just admitted to it.
He's picking his poison, isn't he?
Yeah, he wanted to confess to that and get out of that building and down to juvenile detention.
If they detained him, people need to know in the Commonwealth of Kentucky that there's a good chance that you would have wrote up the citation and the paperwork and he'd been signed out to his mother who was coming down to sit with him.
Absolutely.
That's real. That's real.
Yeah, I'd say murder is about the only charge where you're not concerned that the judge may release him to the parent. But yes, several violent crimes, armed robberies and such, you know, you'll do all the paperwork, contract the appropriate people and get him all ready. And you call the judge and they'll say, well, just go ahead and release him and have his parents meet us in court tomorrow morning. Scary stuff.
Well, and it's so disheartening. And what a slap in the face to the victims or store owners or whomever was the victim to that person that now they're out and they can come visit you again tomorrow.
Well, that could be a whole nother show. So, but you know, that's we'll just leave it at this. That's what's affecting a lot of communities right now. And there's not a lot of discussion. So we'll save that. We might have a good philosophical discussion one night about that, but that's what definitely is going wrong in most communities right now.
Yeah. I think you should bring in a judge maybe to explain why certain ones get released and why they're repetitive offenders and what their thought process
is. I'd like to hear it.
Why they do bond.
Because that risk being transferred out to the community is speaking now. Well, in Lexington, I mean, almost daily, there's a shooting somewhere with 30 or 40 pieces of brass left behind.
Absolutely,
there is. And how we're passing over that, but we're going to get, let's go down that rabbit hole another time. Yeah.
So you talk to Guy A, who's the mailman guy. He tells you about Guy B, who's sitting in the next room. Does he tell the whole story of what happened, or does he just say, I know he did this murder, but I don't know details?
He tells Rob and I that a suspect for the murder told him that he did do it and what he did afterwards. And we record that. But
he was not there to see it with his own eyes.
Okay. That's correct.
So you let him tell his story. Mm-hmm. You gather this knowledge. And now you leave him sitting and you go over to Guy B.
No, we put him back in the holding area, right? We want the guy that's a suspect in the homicide to hear how long we've been gone. So we walk him back to the holding cell. Rob says, thank you, loud enough for the other guy to hear. I remember this like it was yesterday because of this case. But
yeah, it was something like, thank you so much for the cooperation. It's really going to help the case.
Then, you sneaky devil, you.
Then we go after the first cell, we pull suspect A for the homicide out. He's still got quite an attitude, pretty cocky. We walk down, and when we say juveniles, this kid was 16 years old, but he's probably 5'10".
So he's a big guy?
Yeah, probably goes 170, maybe, would you say?
Yeah, it's approximate, yeah.
So I want to get the picture that they're juveniles, but yet they're pretty good size. And
yeah, they're not children.
No.
They're not sixth grade.
Yeah. I'm not taking his hand and leading them to the interview room.
Yeah. And it's frustrating because because they are juveniles, we can't mention their name. So it does get confusing when we're saying suspect A, suspect B.
That's why I was referring to them to the postman and the murder.
Right. Yeah. It can get confusing, but for legal issues, it's probably best that we don't say their names.
And I'll let Rob talk about this interview with suspect A of the homicide, because this is where you kind of, you shined. Yeah. I'll just say
this.
So
you two take him in the room. He still has a bit of an attitude. You set him down and what happens?
Well, of course, we always offer them another drink and anything else that they need.
Sure. And Chris had gotten him glass of water and a styrofoam cup, and he put him back in the holdover cell. But this individual had, through the course of the interview, wound up stating that he named another individual as being responsible for the shooting. So we had not heard this name in the investigation, but that doesn't mean a lot. You know, we miss some stuff or people don't provide the information, so we look into it. Very quickly into this, we realize that that individual was not involved. So he's actually throwing an innocent person under the bus. And, you know, if we didn't do our due diligence or other detectives didn't process stuff the way they should have, you know, an innocent person could be charged with murder.
So Guy B with the attitude was innocent?
No, he simply was deflecting our investigation by pointing to another individual.
I see. Okay. So he was the guy that was appointed, but he's putting it off onto someone else.
Correct. And, okay. And we talked about that. That's a special kind of evil. It's one thing for you to deny involvement, but when you readily name another individual,
you're just going to throw somebody else under the bus.
Knowing that they could potentially be charged with murder and heaven forbid, convicted and spend 20, 30 years in prison, knowing that the knowledge you have is not accurate.
Right.
That's a special kind of mean that you don't come across all the time.
So he starts telling you of this other person. Do you all just let him talk?
Oh, absolutely. And while we're doing this, other detectives are getting the information and they're checking into this individual. And it wasn't long, was it, Chris, that we figured out that it was, you know, not accurate information. But we let him keep talking.
Probably 30 minutes into the interview. And I want all the listeners to know it just didn't. We walk into the room and this is what happens. Remember, Rob said it took 40 minutes or 45 minutes for this individual to admit to the robbery. He, you know, prove that I'm there and so forth. But he didn't really put up a argument against doing the robbery. So then you got to start asking a juvenile these tough questions about a homicide. So it took a little bit to get to that. And it didn't take long for him to throw that innocent person under the bus. So we're probably an hour, hour and a half into the interview at this point. So that's when Rob and I and the other detective send us a message, hey, this guy alibis out. It's not your guy. So, Rob, we continue to talk to him.
And he eventually broke down. We kept confronting him with the evidence and information that we got and recovered the keys and alluded to people observing him, you know, going into the dumpster. So, at that point, he kind of knew he was had. And with the information that he gave on the innocent individual, we were able to disprove that and basically confront him with being a liar and that we can put him there. He then gave the names of the two other individuals that were involved in the homicide.
So then you check that out because maybe he's lying again.
Sure.
Right. His credibility is
not
really,
it's not that good
it's
at this
hurt
point,
us,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, he gives us those other players. But one thing Rob and I have each of them do, and with this first one, is since they're juveniles, I want them to draw out on a map where each of them were. And, of course, during an interview, and this even happens with adults, they're going to try to put themselves the furthest from that crime, least culpable. I didn't know that was going to happen. It wasn't me. I was just there. It was an accident. Yeah, I would never do that, but he would do it, right? That's what they're going to do. So I want them to, Rob and I had them draw a map so that I could see which two maps would match where each person was, right? Because it's two out of three. It's majority wins in this case.
So at this point, somebody goes and picks up these other two people.
Well, it's late in the evening. We already know that we have the other two people that we have to probably collect. So what we do is we call a judge and we type up warrants for their arrest, basically.
About the same age as the suspect?
Yes. They go to a local high school here in Lexington.
So he drops the names of these two. You all verify that they possibly are involved. You get this drawn up by the judge, but you don't – do you hold the guy over this night? He's, I guess, now –
He's charged with murder. He's going to a juvenile detention center.
So tomorrow you all are going to go gather these other two people, right?
First thing in the morning, we have to find out where they go to school. And the reason we wanted to, I know it's dramatic, but it is true. The reason we wanted to do it at school is to send a message, one, that they aren't as tough as they thought, and we're going to do it in front of all their peers. And two, even back in 2004, the community was worried about this violence because a lot of things were going on in that neighborhood at the time. So we figured, well, if it's more juveniles, if they see what really happens, the consequences of their actions, maybe they'll think twice about doing those things. So we went to a gym class of one of the suspects, grabbed him out of the gym, and handcuffed him in front of all his peers.
Good. A little force multiplier there.
Absolutely.
But to go back to this whole thing with the juvenile system, if parents are listening, just think, who's at school with your kid today?
Oh, yeah.
It's frightening.
We've gone to so many schools and pulled out shooters and killers that, people in the community don't really realize that or think about it. But, yeah, there's some bad people running around with your kids and sitting in class right next to you.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Identified and released and let out. Yes. And again, that's a whole – we talk about pandemics and epidemics. It's horrible. But go on.
Yeah. What was the look on the faces of the other students when you all walked in? And what was the look on the face of the person that you put handcuffs on?
Well, as I recall, they were playing basketball in the gym for gym class. When we walked in, the kids kind of went to the sidelines and to the baseline, and we just grabbed that juvenile out of the line, turned him around to face everybody, and we handcuffed him and walked him out of the gym. And it was completely silent.
Did he say anything?
You're playing a basketball game with no fans there.
Did he say anything? You've got the wrong guy. What are you doing?
No.
He knew.
And that's a sign, right?
Oh, he knew. Big time, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't utter a word until we got him in the car and then got him down to headquarters and started the interview.
Who got the other guy? Was he at the same school
or a different school? Place? He was not found in school. He was found at a girlfriend's house.
How did you all, before we get into what happened with the guy on the basketball court, how did you find the guy? How did you even know where to go?
This person that we arrested in the gym, he provided that information.
Okay, so you get the guy from the gym back down to headquarters. Does he sing? Does he get angry? Does he tell what's going on? What happens?
Well, what happens is we put him in the holding cell again.
Got that styrofoam cup of water back out.
Yeah, and a funny thing happened with this one. So we knew he was probably going to be, charged, but he may have been one of our better witnesses at the scene. Would you agree?
Yeah, just his demeanor and such. He was a follower, not a leader. If we had to pick the three, he would be certainly one that I wouldn't anticipate being the shooter, just kind of more of a follower, be there. So, and that's kind of what we picked on from his attitude and demeanor. He wasn't disrespectful, wasn't mean, very polite. You could tell he was nervous and scared. So didn't really seem like a killer to me.
So what does he tell you during this interview? Does he say, yeah, we were there? Or do you, what kind of information do you get from him that leads you to know that he was there and to find out about the third guy?
Well, since you asked, the first thing that we knew we had the right person was when we went back to pull him out of the holding area to bring him to an interview room, that styrofoam cup that I gave him to have the drink of water in, he had ripped up into pieces and spelled out on the bench in little pieces of that cup, Lord help me.
Wow. Wow. Did you acknowledge it when you walked in and said, what is that?
Not at first. We looked.
But you saw it.
And turned around, yeah. And then towards the end of the interview, we asked, and he said, I'm sorry. That's all he said.
Well, we need to hear the stuff that leads up to that, but that's still phenomenal. Never seen that before. I never heard of that.
I really wish all of them went that way, right, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely.
So he seemingly had remorse, as much remorse as you can have for shooting an innocent victim while she's unloading her car. So he tells you all the whole, does he tell how it gets, how it unfolds?
Of course, not at first. He did the typical, I don't know what you're talking about. I heard about it.
Yeah, every interview goes that way. Denial, denial, denial. You put enough information in front of them, they'll adapt to that information. And on that second version of events is probably about 50% fact. And then you confront them again until you wind it down. And, you know, I'm a believer that you never get 100% truth, because if they were truthful, they'd basically be admitting that they're a monster. So they're going to leave out some facts that probably don't put them in the best light. But if you can get into that 90% range that's corroborated by the evidence and other statements, you know you've got a good statement.
Perfect analogy. I think what you're usually trying to do is open a window for them that fits where you think they want to be. That's why I've always looked at it. And knowing that it'd still be BS in the end.
You have to give somebody, when you're talking about the most horrific crime in society, which is taking someone's life, you have to give them an out, is what we call it too, right? You have to give them a reason or an excuse. You have to give them their what they perceive as an out.
Their rationalization that doesn't make sense for you and me.
That's correct.
Perfect. Yeah.
So this is where Rob and I and the lieutenant talk about, he's not giving it up right away. So we get him close enough to admitting he was there and he knows about it. So we decided that's when we play the recording of suspect A, who is pretty cocky about it. And what do we have to, it's his best buddy, right? He was with him that night. He admits to being there. So we play a little bit of the recording. We have it set just so we can play it. And you can see the typical body language, head down, his chin goes all the way to his chest. And he just slumps in the chair. Then he's ready. It was obvious he's going to tell. I said, so now this is a typical thing we say. Now it's just your side of the story. You're able to tell it. Are you going to let your buddy tell it like this? It's up to you. So
yeah, it's always nice to get the playing off each other, and especially recording. There's a great scene in the movie L.A. Confidential, which is fantastic, an interview and interrogation scene where he's actually talking to two people in two different rooms, but he's going back and forth, and he'll ask one a question in the room and hit the speaker so the other person can hear it, and then he'll turn it off and go back to the other one. And that's kind of what we did in this one. And Chris mentioned the body language. It's such a good feeling in an interview. You can tell when they're going to give it up. It may take 10 more minutes, but they're shoulders slouch. They don't respond to questions. They're just thinking, and you know you've got them. They're just figuring out how to tell you. But yeah, there's that moment where you just know he's going to give it up.
That takes experience and training, because if you're not looking for that and it starts to happen and you're not picking up on it and you decide it's break time, then you'll break the moment. I may or may not have seen people do that before, but yeah, you'll break that mojo in that moment and ruin it.
Yeah, you got to let them breathe a little bit. I've seen detectives that aren't comfortable with the silence, and they keep asking questions where it may tick them off, you know, but you've got to be comfortable in that situation and let them breathe and think it through. I've sat there for 5 minutes and we haven't said a thing. And then you're finally like, it needs to be told.
Yeah.
I can tell that you're going to feel better once you get this off your chest. And that's not really lying. I think they do. You know, people that have an ounce of decency would probably go back, like these three individuals, if you could ask them to go back in time, I bet that they would probably say, I'd rather not, mainly for their own livelihood. But yeah, I think they do feel a sense of relief, because we've seen them after a confession to a murder, they go back in the holdover, fall completely asleep.
Right, right. And you know, when you're talking about how you're not lying, one of my favorite things I used to do in that exact same situation when I finally got them ready to go was, and it's not lying, it's the truth, but I'd say, you tell me what you want to say, and I'll testify to every word of it, even if your attorney tells you not to testify.
Right.
And I might lie a bit.
Absolutely.
And boy, I will testify to everything you say. But it's all that building that rapport with them. Mm. Fantastic stuff.
So he starts talking because you're all patient with him. And does he tell the whole story of how it started, or does he not completely tell it? Where do we go from here to learn how the story unfolded?
Rob, I'll let you tell them what he said. And I think his is probably the most accurate. I'm sure he left out a little bit of what he probably did. But I'll let you go ahead and give the scenario how they came upon Megan from what this juvenile says.
Hey, you know there's more to the story, so go download the next episode like the true crime fan that you are.
The Murder Police Podcast is hosted by Wendy and David Lyons and was created to honor the lives of crime victims so their names are never forgotten. It is produced, recorded, and edited by David Lyons. The Murder Police Podcast can be found on your favorite Apple or Android podcast platform, as well as at murderpolicepodcast.com, which is our website and has show notes for imagery and audio and video files related to the cases you're going to hear. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, and YouTube, which has closed caption available for those that are hearing impaired. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe for more and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or wherever you download your podcast from. Subscribe to the Murder Police Podcast and set your player to automatically download new episodes so you get the new ones as soon as they drop. And please, tell your friends.
Lock it down, Judy.